Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you've just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and if you went down to the woods in July 1999, you were in for a big surprise. Yes, our movie today, The Blair Witch Project, one of the most notorious horror movies in modern film history, I hasten to add, was a phenomenon that no one saw coming, that put people off wooded areas the way that Jaws put people off the sea for months in its aftermath. The reverberations of the film 25 years on are still being felt today, not just in horror, but in movie making at large. It's a tale of a group of indie filmmakers out in the wilderness making a documentary about a mythical witch, is credited with birthing the found footage genre that's become a huge staple of horror filmmaking in the decades since. But maybe more importantly, the film announced to emerging storytellers that in a new era of digital video and the internet, you have the tools to make and market your own movie without needing the permission of gatekeepers. All you needed was imagination. The Blair Witch Project was written and directed by Daniel Myrick and my guest today, Eduardo Sanchez, two friends fresh out of film school. In the conversation you're about to hear, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the film, Ed and I look back at its conception. We get into what psychological tricks found footage as a format plays on the audience's brain to heighten their sense of terror. And you'll discover how deep the mythology of the Blair Witch goes. A mythology that, as you'll hear towards the end of our chat, perhaps isn't finished scaring audiences just yet. There may be more Blair Witch terror on the horizon soon to come. A massive thank you to Ed for being such a fantastic guest, and a big shout out as ever to our Patreon supporters for helping make this show possible. If you like what we do on Script Apart and want to see the show continue to grow, you can join that community by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart, where for the price of a single monthly cup of coffee, you'll get ad-free episodes, chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests, and all sorts of other perks. That address one more time is patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, with no further delays, let's get right into it. This is the brilliant Eduardo Sanchez discussing the first draft secrets of The Blair Witch Project. Thanks everyone for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demeck. So Ed, I've had a lot of filmmakers on this podcast who've influenced me in different ways, but You, sir, are the first filmmaker who's come on the show who I can credit with influencing me into becoming an athlete when I was a kid. There was this kind of wooded area, I should explain, that I had to pass through to and from school every day when I was little. And for years after I watched Blair Witch for the first time, at way too young an age, I was completely unable to walk through that forest area. So I would sprint through them instead. And that was the beginning of me ending up on all sorts of track teams and all that kind of thing. So in addition to all the ways that Blair Witch has changed me as a horror fan and a film fan, it also has that legacy.
Well, thank you, man. You know, it's the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, you know, that's exactly what I would have done. You know, if I had been freaked out there, you know, because when I was younger, it wasn't Blair Witch. It was like these pseudo documentaries, like Legend of Boggy Creek, and in these, like, you know, in the Patterson Gimlin film, which is like that famous footage of Bigfoot walking across the creek bed. Yeah, and every time I saw that, it just freaked me out. And there were some woods behind my house, and yeah, I would not go there at night. So I understand your fear, and it, you know, at least there was some good residual part of it. So congrats.
There certainly was. It really is interesting for me looking back at how primarily I was scared by this movie, which came out, I think, when I was at this very particular age that made me quite susceptible to the swirl of rumors around it. Blair Witch became this kind of mythological thing, Ed, around my playground and in the culture. We're now at the 25th anniversary of this movie, which must be mind-blowing for you. So let me kick off this anniversary conversation of sorts by asking, which of the many legacies of what you and Dan achieved together in 1999 means the most to you today, Ed? Besides, obviously, my short-lived career as a champion sprinter.
Yeah, man, I'm absolutely. Your track career is, I'm very proud of that. You know, man, I mean, it's like, you know, I think that it's, there's so many things that, you know, I owe to Blair Witch. You know, I was talking to you earlier about like just my career and, you know, the fact I'm talking to you. And, you know, I just went to a horror convention in Manchester and, you know, just all the love that people have for this movie and all the passion that they still have for this movie. And then the new, you know, the younger audience, you know, I met a lot of teenagers that had just, you know, seen it recently. And there was a girl that was like dressed up as the Blair Witch, which was, you know, I've never seen that before. But it was cool. I mean, it's just so cool. So to me, it's like, you know, I think the thing I'm most proud of is the fact that like we have, you know, we've motivated people, I think, to make movies or to just get into the film, into filmmaking. Like, you know, Star Wars, as you can see, had a big influence on me when I was a kid. And really got me into like reading about how to, you know, how to make movies and just kind of the technical side of things. And a lot of people come up to me and, you know, I get that a lot where it's like, man, Blair Witch really kind of got me into the movies and also inspired people to like go out and do it, you know, because we were, you know, Dan and I and the rest of the guys that, you know, made Blair Witch, we were like nobodies, you know, we went to a, you know, a good film school, but it wasn't anything famous, you know, but in Orlando, you know, it's a much better film school now than it was. You know, we were kind of nobodies, but we had this idea and we just got, you know, a lot of luck and a lot of hard work. You know, you got to put a lot of work into it, obviously, but, you know, you could come out of nowhere and do, you know, and make this kind of, you know, splash, you know, worldwide splash, which, you know, I mean, and I know it's rare, it's super rare, but still, you can go out there and do, you know, you can make it, you know what I'm saying? You can at least go out and make a movie, you know, you never know what'll happen. So to me, that's, you know, that's kind of the big thing for me is that, like, I never thought I would make a movie that, like, would inspire people in that way. And that's kind of the biggest thing that I'm so proud of, that just kind of, you know, motivating just other people to kind of get up and, you know, and make art, you know?
Yeah, I wondered if that might be the case. Like, it's a movie that we can kind of look back on now and see almost as being kind of the starting pistol for a new age of democratized filmmaking in which, like, anyone can make a movie. The barriers, thanks to technology, were kind of beginning to come down in 1999 and have since pretty much entirely shattered. It sounds like it's a massive source of pride for you, the way that you provided a generation with a blueprint for having an idea, writing that idea, shooting the idea, and then impacting audiences, like almost on imagination alone. Is this all to say then that you've lost count of the number of people who've come up to tell you over the years about the DIY movies they've made inspired by Blair Witch?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, like I work a lot in television now, and, you know, people are always coming up to me once they get to know me, and, you know, I'm pretty easygoing. So, you know, I talk to anybody really, but, you know, they're like, hey, you know, Blair Witch, this, you know, everybody has, you know, a lot of people, most people have at least in the film business, have some kind of Blair Witch story because it was kind of on their radar. But yeah, man, the especially the younger people who like, you know, come up to me and want to talk Blair Witch and really want to geek out on Blair Witch. And then, you know, and a lot of them are like, you know, you're the reason that I got into filmmaking, and it just got me interested in how you guys made it and the marketing, and it just kind of sparked something. So yeah, for me, you know, that's kind of, you know, giving back, you know, filmmaking and, you know, the things we do, the TV, and, you know, sometimes you're like sitting there, you're like, you just seem like it's silly. You know what I mean? Like, we're grown men and we're having, you know, like I did an episode of Charmed where like one of the main characters was this little stuffed, you know, elephant puppet, you know? So you're sitting there trying to direct the puppeteer to, you know, make this puppet come to life, and, you know, you're a grown man, you know, with a bunch of grown people around you, adults, and getting paid to do this. And sometimes it seems very silly. You're like, and also a lot of media is very, you know, disposable, but to be able to like, kind of, you know, just make an impact, you know, a little bit of an impact on people and get them enthused into something, or get them to read more, you know, to you know, to read horror books, or kind of, or look into the, you know, folklore of their area, you know, like I think kind of Blair Witch sparked a lot of that stuff, because there was a lot of different you know, kind of, it had a lot of different ways to explore, you know, getting onto the internet and the documentary we made, and, you know, the folklore and the woods, like, you know, and also had, you know, they had this universal thing of like, people are generally afraid of the woods at night. I know I am. And I think that, you know, just kind of touched, you know, everybody, a lot of people that saw the movie, obviously. But yeah, to me, like being able to like say, you know, to somebody to tell me like, man, you know, you know, I was heading a different direction, you sparked something, you know, this interest, that's just, you know, I'll never get tired of listening to those stories, you know?
Well, one of the other things that sparked, Ed, that I'm sure you've been asked about 100,000 times, is this kind of subgenre of found footage films that Blair Witch spawned. I don't think I've heard you discuss, though, what it is about the particular format that has been so enduring and is capable of doing something to audiences that no other kind of format can. Like, I imagine even as Blair Witch blew up, you couldn't have foreseen the way that the genre would grow and mutate and start to bleed into other genres, like, you know, with Cloverfield, a monster movie, Chronicle, a superhero movie, and so on. As one of the genre's originators, and of course, someone who occasionally returns to that well with films like Exists, what kind of trick do you think found footage plays on our brains that manages to kind of buy our belief and helps us experience horror in this more visceral way? Is there anything you've come to learn, I guess, about the psychology of found footage and why it can sometimes work so powerfully?
I think it just comes from the idea that, you know, the difference between documentaries and narrative films, you know, like, I think that, you know, narrative films, like, you know, even the scariest ones, Exorcist, that's a movie that was, you know, actors and director and, you know, screenwriter and, you know, sets, and it still scares the crap out of you, you know, but it's using that kind of the film part of your brain that, you know, that has to kind of suspend the disbelief of, okay, there's an actor, it's Linda Blair, and, you know, that's, you know, obviously the directed by William Friedkin, and, you know, whatever. But it's still kind of, you know, you got to get in, and that's with every movie, you know, you got to kind of like, you know, even still, you've seen Tom Cruise in a bunch of different roles, you have to accept him in the new role, you know, and that's what, you know, that's why actors can do different roles, you know. And then the found footage, I think, takes advantage of like the documentary side of our brain, like the news, you know, story side of our brain, you know, like basically a handheld camera with somebody in front of it with a microphone tends to like play into like, oh, that's news, or that's a documentary, or that's obviously somebody that's real because it's somebody reporting. And even though, you know, obviously there's the found footage movies, not, you know, none of them really pretend to be real, like, you know, like we did, you know, for Blair Witch, but, you know, and they're lit, you know, and there's, you know, sound, you know, there's soundtrack now, and, you know, they've definitely evolved since Blair Witch, but it still has this thing of that it kind of fools your brain into going a little, kind of skirts the, you know, like walks the line between documentary and narrative. And I think that really just kind of takes you into places and lets the material kind of dive into a different part of your brain that normal horror films just can't get into. And I think that it's just a, you know, it's the same thing that documentaries, like documentaries have a way of like, you know, just sticking with you, especially, you know, obviously the good ones. You know, so there is this, you know, so I think that's just what found footage does, is just kind of fools your brain into thinking that this is real, that there's something, some aspect about this is real. And it's the same thing, you know, now like with YouTube, like, you know, Blair Witch was before YouTube. And I think, you know, there, I am finding that there's a kind of a new generation of fans, like younger people that are getting into Blair Witch. And I think it's kind of like the perfect movie for them because they've grown up on TikTok and, you know, especially YouTube and, you know, just all, you know, Instagram, the videos and, you know, handheld photography and just seeing weird things on video. And I think that, you know, way more than, you know, our generation had, you know, because, you know, the film, the, you know, the way that we capture images is so prevalent now. You know, everybody has a phone that, you know, I mean, pretty much everybody's phone has a much better camera than we shot Blair Witch on, you know, so technology has gone nuts, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. So, you know, I think the new generation is kind of used to it and kind of accepts it, like, oh yeah, that's, you know, whatever. So, but definitely, like, for me, found footage, and it has to be, you know, and there's different ways to do it, obviously, but it does kind of trick you into thinking that you're seeing something real, even though it could be with, you know, actors that, you know, or, you know, are acting. And it just kind of, and that's what, like, for me and Dan, for Dan and I, when we were coming up with the idea for Blair Witch, those are the things that really, like, pushed us into making Blair Witch, was, you know, documentaries. And there was a show called In Search of,
Leonard Nimoy,
I mean, which was, yeah, just, I mean, it's still a creepy show, like his voice and the music and the 16, you know, they shot it all on 16 millimeter film. So it has this kind of, you know, weird film look. And that show really was like the one that was most responsible for Blair Witch, you know, for both Dan and I were very, you know, you just kind of enamored and scared of that show when we were kids. And that's one of the main things we watched when we were coming up with the idea for Blair Witch, is like, does this still work? And we watched a couple episodes and we're like, yeah, this thing still works, man. It, you know, it still creeps you out. You know, and it was funny because we met the guys who made that show, you know, after Blair Witch blew up, you know, and, you know, they were like, nah, man, we just kind of made a lot of that stuff up, you know, and it was so, you know, it was kind of disappointing, even though I kind of knew it, you know, like you know, some of the footage of like the villagers was, it's like, no, it was just like some guys we picked up and, you know, put them in loincloths and put them in the woods there, you know, but it was just, you know, the fact that it was handheld and it was 16 millimeter and the way that Leonard Nimoy, you know, narrated it, it just kind of had so much authority, like, this is real. So, but, you know, so it is the power of that kind of documentary filmmaking, you know, and that's where, you know, really found footage, like, really takes advantage of, you know, of that part of our brain that enjoys and accepts documentaries.
So I've read that, you ended up at film school after, you know, experiencing, In Search Of as a kid and, having your own relationship with horror movies. It sounds like it was in your first or second year at film school that you and Dan had the idea for Blair Witch. And it sounds like the idea was kind of the format itself, to tell a documentary formatted story, but in this raw form, as if like you, the viewer, had stumbled across exactly what they filmed unedited. How quickly did you and the team kind of arrive at the story to fill that format, Ed? I'd love to hear about, like, yeah, the development of the mythology, I guess, of the Blair Witch, and whether there were any other ideas that you spoke about even briefly, like whether for a moment it wasn't going to be a witch out there in the woods, but a monster, an alien, any other kind of threat.
Right, right. I mean, you know, the initial idea was, you know, Dan and I, it was like 91, and Dan and I were, you know, just on the weekends, we had just seen this movie called Freddy's Dead, which was a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And it was, you know, it was a fun movie, but it wasn't really scary. And there hadn't been a, you know, like a really scary movie in a long time. So we went and, you know, did our research. We found tapes of In Search Of, and we watched them. We're like, man, that creeps us out. And so we're like, I wonder if you could do that, you know, to a, you know, to an audience now, you know, in the '90s. And that first weekend was just mostly research and watching those old movies and kind of trying to get, you know, seeing if they worked, you know, and they did work. So you were like, you know, so the whole, the idea was like, it kind of led to like, okay, it's a documentary film crew that goes somewhere. And, you know, and it wasn't really about like the found footage or anything like that. It was more about like, imagine doing a horror movie from, you know, a documentary horror movie, basically, like somebody that, so that, you know, and the house was like the first idea. Like, I think that house came up in the first, that first weekend, where it was like, you know, imagine like you're walking up to, you know, the camera is dark and you've already been through hell, and now you come across this house and it's totally dark, and you go in, and we were thinking like there's pentagrams and, you know, signs of satanic worship, and, you know, can, you know, like burn down candles in a circle, like just some, you know, maybe some goat, you know, some animal remains or something, like something nasty and dark has been happening in this house. And then the idea was, you know, you don't cut, you just have this continuous shot where the audience, you know, there's no cuts, there's no way to like relieve the tension of the audience. And then the idea was, I remember the idea, it's like, okay, there's this creepy door at the end of the hall, and you're slowly going through all the rooms, and you as a viewer know you're going to go down that, you know, you're going to open that door and go into that room, and, you know, going into the room and slowly opening it. And any minute you're thinking something's going to jump out at you, and then going down into the cellar and something, you know, is down there, maybe, you know, kills, you know, grabs the crew or whatever. I'm not sure how far we went, but I remember it being like, yeah, they go into a cellar and whatever. And then the next part was the idea of like the found footage, like, you know, we wanted to make it in the '70s because we, you know, In Search Of was shot on 60 millimeter. So we were like, it has to be shot on 60 millimeter. Like, imagine that they find the, you know, the negative of these, what these guys shot, all their footage, like undeveloped and, you know, underground, you know, and it's stayed cool for all these years, and the film hasn't, you know, some of it has deteriorated, but most of it is still good. And then, you know, somebody develops the footage, and oh my God, there's this whole story, and there's audio tapes and, you know, the audio reels. But we were thinking like 20 years later, they find the footage. And so that was our original idea. That's what Dan and I kind of kept kind of, you know, talking about. And honestly, we kind of had like a little burst, like a lot of projects. You had a little burst of creativity and a little, you know, progress, a little momentum. And then, you know, we were in film school. I had already done a feature. Dan was working on his own feature. So, you know, it kind of everything else got in the way. And every once in a while we would mention it, we would kind of hone in on the, you know, the idea. It was called the Woods movie. We didn't come up with Blair Witch until very much later. And then the kind of the way that, you know, the Blair Witch came from was just basically like, okay, what is this documentary team looking for? You know, and we knew we were going to shoot it somewhere in the United States, you know, either Florida where we were, you know, based, or Maryland where I was based, you know, because we were doing low budget and we knew we were going to need our friends, we were going to need to stay at people's houses, you know, had just the resources were limited. So, you know, either Florida or Maryland's where our resources were. So we were like, yeah, I think Maryland is creepier, it has, you know, more history, and, you know, so, you know, we toyed around with like, what exactly are they looking for? They're looking for some kind of monster, or like, we were thinking for a second, like, you know, it was this creepy old man. But then we like started thinking about, you know, the folklore, like the history of stuff. And, you know, we loved, you know, the Crucible. We love like the Salem witch trial. Like, you know, that was like, you know, it's such an injustice and such kind of backwards thinking, but it was this history that happened, you know, in this area, you know, and we're pretty far from Salem, but still it's, you know, in the same neighborhood, let's say, of the world. And we were like, man, that'd be cool if, you know, something happened to this woman. She was, you know, accused of witchcraft, and they put her, you know, they banished her or they killed her or whatever. We didn't have any of the details yet. And then this area is cursed, like the witch or something comes back and takes all the kids or kills all the kids or kills all the adults or whatever. And there's this thing, the Blair Witch, you know, folklore is invented. And then we wanted to have, you know, like there's the scariest kind of things in, you know, that we in folklore, like the Bermuda Triangle, is the idea that like things happen in this area, just this area, you know, whether whatever reason it is that, you know, things happen in the Bermuda Triangle. So our whole thing was like, this is kind of like the Bermuda Triangle, but in the woods, you know, there's some kind of bad energy there because of this woman being, you know, unjustly tried for witchcraft and basically killed. But we love the idea that there was a pattern, like things still continue to do, to bad things continue to happen. And then we came up with the idea of like every 50 years or so, something bad happens in this area. And it so happens that, you know, the 1994, when these filmmakers, you know, disappeared, it makes sense of one of the 50 year kind of cycles, you know? So it just makes it like creepier and like, oh my God, it's repeating itself, you know? And then, you know, and for us, it was like, you know, the witch thing just made sense. You know, I mean, it could have been the Blair Witch Warlock, but it sounds that doesn't sound right. And also for us, monsters was kind of out of the, once we started looking at the budget and stuff, we realized that we can't, you know, afford to do a monster movie. You know, we can't afford to build a monster or anything like that, anything that looks good. And then another budgetary concern, once we realized that we couldn't shoot it in the 70s, you know, or we couldn't do a period piece. I mean, maybe we could find some cars and the wardrobe would be easy, whatever, but it would limit us very much. And also it would cost us, you know, $20,000 just for the film stock, you know? So we were like, well, they'd have a video camera, you know, kind of doing behind the scenes, which is the only thing video was good for, you know, for TV and, you know, for, you know, soap operas and, you know, TV was, you know, video was not a, what it is today, where it's, you know, most films are shot on video now, you know, back then nothing was shot on video. Doctor Who was shot on video. I remember that, you know? So, you know, and it had like this appearance of live television or whatever, you know, again, news, but, you know, so we were like, well, yeah, I guess they would take a, you know, video camera, you know, to do the behind the scenes, and then they would shoot the documentary on film, because in those times, you know, that was the only way you could get any kind of film into a festival or anything, is to shoot it on film. So, you know, and, you know, Heather is a, you know, she's a poor filmmaker, so of course she's going to do it in black and white. It's a creepy, you know, documentary about the Blair Witch, so yeah, black and white makes sense. It's much cheaper, you know, if you know anything about film, you know, black and white is, you know, like half the cost of, and especially developing it also, it's just cheaper than color. So, you know, we were kind of, and, you know, so we had to move it up to 1994 and, you know, so just a little bit more modern. And, but, you know, it was a very natural way of just kind of like taking it step by step and, you know, kind of saying, all right, it's a documentary film crew. Okay, so where are they going? They're going into the woods. Okay, so what are they looking for? They're looking for something, a witch. Okay, yeah. So we have to come up with some kind of folklore about what, you know, it can't just be a witch in the woods. Like there has to be some history there. And really our thing was like, you know, early on with the idea was like that there is this old woman, you know, supposedly there's rumors that there's this old woman that still lives out there, you know, like she's, you know, timeless, like hundreds of years old, you know, again, you know, again, folklore and people talking and, you know, kind of gossiping about. So that was kind of the original thing. Oh, they're going to go up there to look for the Blair Witch. And then, you know, eventually we were like, you know, just, it's a, you know, we abandoned that whole idea of like actually looking for somebody physically up there. And it was just more about like, let's just go and, you know, see, you know, where this happened, you know? So, you know, and it was just step by step. We didn't shoot the movie. We didn't start working on the movie again until 1996. So about five or six years later, and we didn't shoot it till 1997. You know, we didn't have the money raised and stuff for a year. It took us a year to get some of the money. And so, you know, it's just like, I'm sure, you know, you've talked to a million, you know, writers. It's just the idea of like, you know, when you need the idea, you come up with it, and then you go into the next step and the next step, and all of a sudden you have a story, you know.
And you famously didn't write a script, Ed, because you knew that you wanted the film to be, well, improvised, or at least have improvised dialogue. So instead you just had plot beats. Did those plot beats ever change? Like, were there initial ideas, like the idea of going in search for the physical Blair Witch, that you know, you entertained for a moment, then discarded, either for kind of practical reasons or because you were sharpening this thing into the scariest film it could be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was, you know, definitely, you know, we wanted it to be completely real. So everything that was, you know, based around the making the movie was real. The initial idea in 91 was just, you know, this kind of just a little bit of an idea, like filmmakers disappear, their film is found 20 years later, and, you know, somebody makes a documentary about it. And then once we started getting into, you know, I remember 1996, I was in a dead end job in traffic in the, you know, and I called up Dan on my flip phone and I said, "Hey man, I don't know about you, but I'm in a dead end here, man. I need to do something. And I think we should make the Woods movie because it's the best idea we have." And everybody, you know, every time we pitched it, people were like, "Oh my God, yeah, I'd love to help," or whatever. And Dan was in a similar situation, not as bad as me, but he was definitely like, "All right, we got to do something." So we started, you know, again, back and forth, you know, story beats. And that's when stuff really started kind of happening. And it was just, how many nights are we going to be out there? Let's, you know, what, something happens, obviously, each night, everything escalates. What kind of stuff are they finding during the day? You know, are we what are we revealing? So, you know, you came up, you know, we slowly came up with this script. And again, it was like a normal, I don't know, 35 pages. I haven't seen it in a while, but I think between 30 and 35 pages. And it was basically a script without dialogue. It was just kind of beat by beat. And it described, like, you know, again, some character beats of like how people are feeling. And obviously, as, you know, as the desperation grows, they kind of start, you know, butting heads, and they're lost, and they have to get back home, and they have to get the equipment back. Just kind of the basic, you know, especially once we decided that they were like not professional filmmakers, that they were student filmmakers, you know, that they're just, you know, a little bit less responsible, you know what I mean? Like, when there's no money, it's just, you don't make the best plans when they're, you know, in those years in college, you know, you just go out and shoot it. And that's what we loved about it also, is the idea that like Heather just kind of went, you know, "Oh, I'm going to do a movie about the Blair Witch," and just kind of, you know, got along. We gave them those, you know, kind of directives. But the script was, you know, beat by beat was kind of, you know, there. And then we realized that, you know, the reason we didn't write dialogue was that, you know, we wanted it to appear like real footage. And we realized that, you know, you can't do lines, you can't do kind of line readings. Even the movies, the found footage movies that I've done since Blair Witch, we've written dialogue, but I very much like tell them, "Hey, look, memorize the dialogue, but, you know, you can make it your own. Like, there isn't anything where I'm going to be like, 'Hey, this is the sentence you need to say,' you know, as long as you hit the beats of the scene," because obviously, you know, it's going to look more natural. It's going to feel better. But for Blair Witch, it was just like, no, we just need it to be real. That's why they, you know, we asked them, "Hey, can we use your real name so that you guys don't have to, like, when you call each other, you don't have to think of your character name. You can just go right to, you know, the person's name. You know, there's a more of a connection. There's less, you know, there's less acting," we thought. Like, there's, you know, a wall was kind of put up, was taken away, but, you know, using their real names. And then, you know, the beats changed as we moved along. Like, we, you know, there's like every night there's a gag, let's say. And we were at first, we're like, "Okay, you know, of course, there's got to be a gag where they hear footsteps around the tent a little bit. And, you know, and then the second night they hear more footsteps and more people running around. And it's obviously something is out there. The first night is kind of like, man, I don't know if I, you know, heard anything with it. And then, you know, just the beats that happen after that, you know, like the Stickman Forest was something that we came up with. And the idea that like they walk, you know, in one direction all day and they end up in the same place, you know, like that was something. And we just kind of moved them like, oh, that should come later, you know. You know, we knew that somebody was going to be, you know, eventually we're going to have they just wake up and somebody's gone, you know, and then that night they hear them screaming from the woods, you know, like to us, it was just like, God, man, that'd be terrifying. Like, you know, and you can't find them. And, you know, so it just kind of started coming together. And also like, you know, the visitations of, you know, they wake up in the morning and there's these little rock piles and we wanted to keep it everything natural. Like we wanted to keep it, you know, we didn't want the gags to be crazy, even though we came up with some crazy gags. Cause you know, it's like kind of like, all right, how are we gonna scare people? Like, you know, and the idea of like a horror movie is that, you know, there has to be some visual stuff, you know, mostly. So we had ideas like, you know, putting people like off into the woods and then hitting them with like a flash, you know, so you get just one frame and so you kind of see this like image of a person, but it's so dark that, you know, you're not looking directly at it. So you get these little glimpses of, you know, we were playing with all kinds of stuff. We had a bunch of scenes that didn't make it. Like there's a scene where they come across this campfire, like it's lit and they're like, what the hell, you know, but we were like, all right, where does that go? You know, but kind of a, you know, just unexplained creepy things that they found. I think there was a beat where they find like this carcass of like a deer splayed out and in a weird like sacrificial way, you know, like not really hunters, but you know, just, you know, like obviously like a sacrifice, you know. And then so all those ideas kind of, you know, kept, you know, being put into the outline and then being taken out, and then by the end, you know, we had this script and it was amazing because, you know, we directed the movie using mostly with these little directing notes, because at first we were going to, you know, we had this script and we were like, okay, how are we going to direct this? And Dan and I had not really talked about how exactly we were going to direct this. So we started talking about, okay, we should definitely leave them alone for a little, you know, for a few hours, let them do a couple scenes and then come back, look at the footage and say, all right, we want this, you know, we want to redo this and you do this, you say this, I don't want you to say this. I want you to go walk this way, kind of direct them and then let them do it again. So because, you know, we never imagined that we were going to be there watching them and having, you know, because we wanted the camera to be able to go 360. We didn't want to have to, you know, hide the crew. And also, you know, we knew that this was kind of a psychological experiment. So we wanted them to, you know, leave them isolated as much as possible. And then Greg Hale, our producer, was like, why don't we just leave them in the woods? You know, why don't we just leave them for, you know, the whole time in the woods? And we were like, can we do that? And they're like, he was like, sure, of course you can. We can do that. And at first Dan and I were like, you know, how are we going to do this? And also, you know, you're afraid because you're giving so much creative. You're already giving the actors control over the dialogue, you know, but now you're like really giving the actors control. Like you can't set up camera shots and you can't say, you know, point this way. I mean, it's all like just, you know, basically like remote control, you know, filmmaking or directing. And but you know, once, you know, we trusted these actors. I mean, we had gone through like 1,000 people and we knew that these people were like gonna, you know, deliver. Like they were just freaking brilliant. And so we you know, Greg came up with a system of like, you know, having GPS and being able to like guide them, you know, from waypoint to waypoint during the day and giving this, you know, having waypoints where we would give them supplies, which included, you know, food and batteries. And then they could leave like their, you know, used tapes and whatever they needed. If they needed underwear, you know, whatever it is, you know, they would ask for stuff. And then, you know, in each of those waypoints, there was directing notes for each of the actors and they weren't allowed to show them to each other. And that's how we directed them. You know, there was not only like, you know, information about the character, about like, oh my God, Heather's driving you crazy. You know, she's lost. She doesn't know where she's going. You got to be back man, you got to be back 8 a.m. back at the thing. Your boss is going to kill you because you weren't supposed to take out this equipment. And, you know, just kind of like the things that, you know, I know that, you know, college students kind of worry about in their lives. You know what I mean? And we kind of just played them against each other. And then, you know, just, you know, and obviously it was, you know, testament to their skill as, you know, as actors that they pulled it off. But it was, and then so we did all these things, and, you know, Dan and I got back in the editing room, and there were so many little surprises, obviously. Then that's what we kind of wanted. We were like, we have all these scenes kind of scripted, but we know there's going to be all kinds of little things here and there. And, you know, and we instigated some of the fighting, but there was a lot more fighting than, you know, we instigated. In fact, most of the film is them arguing, honestly. And, it's 22 hours. It's about, you know, 15 hours of them walking through the woods arguing. So Dan and I really, like, we wrote the movie in the editing room, and we were amazed that, like, we had pretty much gotten all of the beats that we had written in the script in the footage. Like, we had everything, and we had more than that because we had these scenes that we had never even thought of. Like, and that was really for us an amazing experience, because as a filmmaker, you know, you're there on the set, you're looking at the monitors, you know what you're shooting, you know the angle, you know, you do a take, you tell the director, you know, tell the actor, give direction, you the camera person slower move, or, you know, whatever, you give, you know, whatever it is, and then you do another take until you see it right, and then you go on to the next thing. So you know the footage, you've already experienced it. So if there's a laugh, you've already suppressed it until cut, and everybody laughs. If there's like a scary beat, you're like, oh my God, that's so cool. Or if there's a cool shot or whatever, you experience it as you're shooting it. But for us, it was like, you know, we were basically, they were shooting the movie and then we were watching it. So it was very much like we had discovered this footage by these three filmmakers, and now we had to put a story together using their footage. So there was like things like Mike, the most famous one is like Mike kicking the map into the creek. Like, that was not scripted. You know, that was just something where Mike foolishly kicked this thing into the creek one day and watched it float away. And he was sure that, you know, Heather and Mike and Josh were going to see it and go, hey, we got to get the map. And they were going to go in and get it, you know, and there was going to be a whole scene of them trying to grab the map from the creek as it floated off, but nobody saw it. And he was like, oh my God, what do? I just kicked the map into the creek. So a lot of the arguing, you'll notice that, you know, that day was them arguing about the map, you know. And actually Mike and I were just together at, you know, this convention in Manchester. And we talked about that, like, in more detail about, like, how exactly that map thing happened. And he was like, and I was like, dude, so, you know, it was so cool because there's a really big scene, you know, after he kicks the map, where they can't find the map, and Heather and Josh are like, you know, don't make me go through your clothes, and, you know, they're arguing. It's this really intense scene, and Mike is like, you know, 50 feet away and saying, come on, we're wasting time. And I'm like, that little bastard knew that they weren't going to find the map. You know, he was just keeping the secret. And then he told, you know, he was telling me that he just kept it for a while and just, you know, figured out, you know, a good time to show it, you know, to tell them that he had kicked the damn map into the creek. And so we watched that scene as, you know, as an audience member, you know, where, cause, you know, we had, you know, there's no script. We're like, what? It's a new scene. So we were like, you know, just like amazed by this, you know, these scenes, that especially that one where they kind of start hitting each other, and there's like, it's the closest they get to like real, you know, physical altercation. And, you know, and it was kind of dangerous. We were at a certain point, we're like, oh my God, did he punch him or did she punch him? Or, and it was like, just watching it, it was just really like, for us, we were like, oh my God, if we're feeling this way, imagine like an audience member that hasn't seen any of this and hasn't scripted any of this stuff, you know? But again, you know, since this is, you know, a screenwriting, you know, podcast, like, the movie was really written in the editing room, you know, like, yeah, like the plans that we had for the script, and every movie changes, you know, obviously when you write it, when you shoot it, when you edit it, changes each time you do that. But for this one, like the real script writing was done in, you know, in the editing room.
I can totally see that because, you know, the pacing of the film is part of its magic. And I love the way there's this kind of like gradual ratcheting up of the threat. And there's this gradual erosion as well of any other explanation other than supernatural. Every time something scary happens, and crucially, you know, you did away with that idea of the deer carcass. What we're left with instead is just sticks and stones, essentially, but it's so chilling. Each time we have one of these kind of like very unsettling events, like whether it's the stones in front of their tents or whatever it is, you then intersperse that with like these quite human moments. And I think like those go under the radar when we talk about Blair Witch. I mean, there are so many amazing little vignettes and little moments within the film where we get to connect with these characters and we get to see some of their humanity. And I think that really contributes to, you know, how chilling the ending is, because you have come to care about them in some way. Like at one point, Heather talks about what she'd give to be back home eating a plate of pumpkin pie with ice cream. And there's like another moment that's really interesting in which, God, I think the characters start singing the national anthem because bad things can't happen in America. And, you know, they're there putting their faith in a flag that can't save them now. Can you tell me about like finding the ways to make your audience kind of really care for these characters in the edit? Because as I say, I don't think the ending hits the same way without, for example, that moment of innocence and normalcy, Heather craving some pumpkin pie.
I mean, you know, like our thing was that, you know, you're stuck with these characters, you know, in a normal movie, you know, I mean, there's some movies that stay with the one character and you're just kind of basically tagging along. But most movies have scenes, you know, like elsewhere. And that was the original idea for the movie. You know, when we were shooting the stuff in the woods, our idea was like, we'll use like maybe half an hour of this. The rest of it will be, you know, documentary footage of like people, you know, talking heads and, you know, detectives and scientists and people were going to, you know, we were going to, you know, look at the footage and like, you know, analyze the footage and find frames with weird things on it and stuff. So, you know, that was the movie for us. And then, you know, so there was going to be a lot of no more narrative kind of normal documentary stuff in the movie. We're going to go back and forth between the footage. But then once we started editing the movie and we realized that every time you cut away from the woods, you just lost all momentum and you basically just were waiting to get back to the woods, you know? And so we kind of, you know, eventually cut all that stuff out and used it later on for, you know, a documentary called Curse of the Blair Witch. And so it was very much like, you know, that was kind of, you know, it like the so it was never supposed to be, you know, it was never supposed to be a movie. You know what I mean? And then so Dan and I got back to the editing room. We're like in the editing room and the whole mythology, you know, the whole, I guess, you know, logistical information or the story was that Heather's mother, the police had, you know, investigated this footage for about a year and then they found nothing conclusive and they gave it back to Heather's mother because Heather was the filmmaker and it was her, you know, so, you know, who else are you going to give it to? You got to give it back to the family. So Heather's mother just trying to find answers to, you know, where, you know, her kid is and where, you know, these other guys that her friends went, she hired Hacks and Films, which is our company, to do a documentary about this. So Dan and I were like, okay, we can't handle 22 hours of footage. Plus there's a lot of footage of like us in it, you know, because there is some behind the scenes stuff. There's stuff where, you know, things didn't work out. And there's also, you know, them fooling around. Sometimes they would, you know, leave, you know, come out of character just for a little while, just to kind of, you know, refresh themselves and just kind of, you know, I guess keep their sanity, you know? So we were like, let's just cut all that stuff out and let's try to come up with some kind of like narrative. So we came up with this like 2.5 hour cut and that was our footage. So then from that we were, you know, let's get the movie. But, you know, for us, it was like, you know, we got to know, cause we didn't really know, you know, Heather, Mike and Josh, when we cast them, you know, they were just people out of New York. And when they showed up, we had only, you know, been with them a few hours in callbacks. And then we got to know them a little bit during pre-production, but the pre-production was only a few days. Wow. So we sent them into the woods without really knowing these people. So Dan and I kind of got to know them with the footage. And we, you know, Dan, it was a really great relationship with that Dan and I had, where we just kind of trusted each other completely. So, you know, we were like, okay, we got 2 hours, you know, 2.5 hours, 3 hours of footage. Let's start cutting stuff out. So we would cut stuff out, and then I would go, he would come in, edit, and cut some stuff out. And that, at that point, it was just cutting stuff. And then I would come in and see, oh, he cut this. Yeah, he's right. And then I would cut stuff. And then, so we got it down to a, you know, certain level. And then, you know, we kind of massaged it by, you know, again, adding these like little human moments, just stuff that we loved, you know, like just, oh my God, we got to keep that. Oh my God, that's good. Or you got, you know, just all these. And there's so much stuff that we had to cut out. You know, that was just really, really good little scenes and good lines and stuff. But, you know, we knew we were going to be, you know, at around a hour and a half. So, because we were like, how, you know, these people are not going to be able to sit through much, much longer than that, you know? So that, you know, we wrote that and all, and it's one of those things where, like, you know, the kind of the biggest adjustment, again, like, you know, I said, I was talking about how we wrote the script, in the editing room, but in the actual footage, Josh and Heather were really butting heads, like, I think personally and character wise. There was just like something was, you know, Heather was definitely, we told her, like, you're a strong, you know, filmmaker, don't take any shit from these guys. And, you know, it's your movie, you got the money together to buy this stock and this and that. So, and she took it like really, really seriously. And both of them, both Mike and Josh, were like, hey, you know, actually, that was one of the early times that they actually, you know, wanted to talk to one of the directors. And they talked to them, they're like, oh man, Heather's going a little, it's a little too much. And, you know, we're having a hard time connecting with her. So, you know, we came back to Heather and said, hey, you know, let's bring it down a little bit. We have 8 days out here. So you don't want to like start at 11 from the first day. And she took direction well, but still her and Josh, I mean, they're all three super smart people and like very, you know, aware of what they're doing. And I think Heather and Josh just kind of, you know, butted heads more. So in the editing room, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we pulled Josh instead of Mike. Mike was, when we were shooting the movie, Mike, the sound man, the sound guy in the movie, in the callbacks, which is what we did in New York, he was always the one that disappeared. Cause we used that scene as a callback scene during the callbacks in New York to cast the movie. So they knew that Mike was like, I'm pretty sure that I'm leaving early, you know. And, you know, he said he was really kind of shocked that when he woke up and Josh was gone, you know, because we didn't tell him that Josh was leaving. So, and that was one of the reasons that we watched a lot of the footage and we were like, man, Heather and Josh are just arguing so much, and there was turmoil, and we're like, you know, let's see what Mike and Heather are like, you know, in the, you know, so, you know, we made a good decision. And also Josh was ready to get the hell out of there. Like he was so grateful to be leaving the woods. So during the editing room, you know, we had all this arguing with Josh, but we were like, it would be a lot more interesting if Mike and Heather were the ones butting heads. And then Josh was the friendly one, kind of like, you know, in between. And then once we remove him, it's just Mike and Heather. And they're like, there's no, you know, cushion. There's no, referee. And even though, you know, Heather and Mike, Heather and Joshua, obviously they fight in the, you know, first part of them. I mean, you know, they're caught in this really tense situation. So there's going to be flare ups and stuff, but we cut out 95% of Josh and Heather fighting, and there was a few times when Mike and Heather got into it, and we played those up, we extended those. Every time there was a moment with Mike and her, we brought it into the edit, and we wrote the movie as we were editing. And that's kind of what creates this nice little thing at the end where, like, you know, when Josh leaves, there all of a sudden the mood changes, you know what I mean? There's like a different kind of tension, but it's more like they're more they're kind of coming together. Like they know they're in this situation, and they become more comrades, like fighting the same thing instead of just adversaries, you know? And we really love that. We really love that kind of turn in the footage. And again, like, you know, to make a long story, you know, out of this, a long answer to your question, you know, it's just the idea that, like, you know, we got to know the characters as the audience did. So Dan and I, as, you know, this editing team, would just kind of brought out all these little cool little moments that we loved, and pulled away the ones that we didn't, you know, want. So, you know, again, and obviously, you know, it was a testament to, like, you know, Heather, Mike, and Josh, that they built these characters and we were able to like them, and they became very, you know, they were very human, you know, these three people, like, you really believed in it. And also, I think that, you know, again, like, going back to our original idea, you were stuck with these people, you know, like, you're just the camera turns on and you're there, you're in among them talking, and you feel like, you know, the fourth member of the part of the, you know, of the filmmaking team. So I think that, it really just worked to kind of, not only were they great, but I think just the format of it was really, you know, really led to, like, to having these little real moment, human moments, because they were kind of going through these real human moments. They were hungry and they were tired. And you know how it is sleeping in the woods, like, you can't really sleep well. So after 5 or 6 days of sleeping in sleeping bags, you know, and being stinky and just, like, you know, sleeping in the same, you know, tent with two other people, you know, all that kind of stuff started, you know, kind of playing with them. And that was our goal. You know, we knew that, like, man, if we get really great improv actors and we throw them in the woods and we kind of torture them, you know, with obviously their cooperation, you know, their permission, you know, we're going to get some cool stuff. And that was, like, you know, that was kind of the way we, you know, the plan. It was just like, let's put them in the situation and then just see how they act, you know?
You mentioned the ending there, Ed, and the way there's this tonal shift in the film after Josh disappears. I suppose the ending is kind of constructed of two kind of big points, I suppose. There's first and foremost, Heather's address to camera, her kind of apology, this heartbreaking moment that just trembles with terror and regret. There's also, of course, like, that harrowing image that the film ends on of Mike facing the corner. And I know that there were a couple of different endings that you actually shot. I've seen a few of them on the Blu-ray. Can you tell me what worked so well about that shot of him facing the corner and the kind of callback to a part of the Blair Witch myth that we've heard earlier on in the film that didn't work about those other ideas that you explored?
Well, I mean, the ending was kind of, you know, really strange. I mean, like the way it came about was that we started shooting the movie, and Dan and I knew that we were going to end it in the cellar of this house. Was the original idea that we came up with very early in the coming up with the story. And but we didn't know what was going to happen in that cellar. We were like, what the hell do they see and what happens? So we started shooting the movie, and Dan and I were like trying to come up with ideas and, you know, thinking about it. And then the producer Greg would come in and be like, "Do you guys come up with an ending yet?" And we were like, "No." And they're like, "Well, you got 6 days, you know?" And then it got to a point where we were like 3 days out, and Greg was like, "Well, now you've made it where, like, the art department is not going to be able to build you anything. Like, we, you know, the art department only has a certain amount of, you know, we don't have many resources. They're already doing a million different things. So you're basically have to come up with an idea that requires no additional art department, unless it's something very simple." So, you know, luckily we came up with this idea of just, you know, the idea of, like, somebody being, you know, not responding. Like, why would Mike not respond to Heather's screams? And why is he standing in the corner? So we just shot it, and we were just like, whatever, man, let's just, you know, that's the only way we can shoot it. We were also thinking that, you know, it would be relatively easy to come back and reshoot it, you know, if we needed to. So we was like, okay, that's the way we ended. That's fine. Let's just do it. So, you know, as we edited the movie, we really loved this ending, and you know, it worked out really well. And we were like, yeah, man, I can't believe we came up with it so late in the process, but it's a good ending. And then artists and the distribution company came in and was like, we wanted a different ending. People aren't really getting the ending. And we were like, well, you know, I don't know what, you know, we like our ending, whatever. And they were like, well, we'll pay you money to go back to Maryland. And we were like, yeah, all right. Cause at that point we hadn't delivered the movie yet. And we were still, you know, very poor. And like, you know, we went through some tough financial times there during the Blair Witch days. So we went back to Maryland and we shot the alternate endings, which were kind of goofy and just, you know, way too over the top. But also while we were there, we shot this interview with the guy talking about how Rustin Parr made the kids, you know, stand in the corner while he killed, you know, the other one. And that was something that we had come up with while building the website for the movie. You know, I was doing a lot of mythology for the movie and we were like, just kind of thinking about the Rustin Parr story and how many kids are 7 kids, and we named the kids, and you know, just all this information that we were putting up on the website to make it like, you know, like historically accurate, at least, you know, within the Blair Witch mythos. And we came up with the idea of like, you know, that he took the kids 2 by 2 down to the cellar and he would make one of them face the corner while he killed the other one, which is a, you know, really dark thought. Really dark idea. And we were like, we know that a lot of people aren't gonna pick up that thing because it happens, you know, early in the first act, and that, you know, it doesn't pay off till the very end of the movie. And usually, you know, movies don't do that. Movies remind you right before it happens of what's gonna happen, you know, the significance or the twist of the ending, you know. And, but, you know, this is not a movie that's a normal movie. So we were like, all right, some people are going to get it, some people are not, but the people are going to get it, it's going to be really creepy to like see that image and think back, oh my God, that's the way Rustin Parr used to kill the kids. So it has something to do with Rustin Parr, who was, you know, killed in the fort, was hung in the 40s. And how is this happening? You know, again, to give it this supernatural edge of like, you know, why would, unless Mike was in on it, why would Mike stand in the corner and not turn around when Heather, you know, is there. So, you know, again, we went and we shot it. So basically the movie that we showed at Sundance did not have that interview in there, did not have that explanation of why Mike was standing in the corner. And it was only till later on, as we were editing the movie, that we came up with the idea of like, you know, the Rustin Parr connection. And then, you know, later on, you know, artists, and I remember we were mixing the sound of the movie again, and the one of the executives, Bill Block, who was kind of like our friendly executive, good guy, we're still friends and to this day, and he called me, and I was talking for me and Dan, for Dan and I, and he said, all right, so what ending do you guys want to go with? And we were like, I was like, Bill, we want to go with the original ending. We just think that, you know, it makes more sense. The other ones are just doesn't, you know, they don't make any sense and whatever. And he was like, okay, it's going to cost us millions at the box office, but we'll go with your ending. And, you know, I remember, like, first of all, you know, it was cool that they let us have our ending, you know, they let us choose, you know, and, you know, Artisan was really great to us up until the movie started making a lot of money. And then all of a sudden things change, but it happens all the time in all businesses. But the idea that they let us have our, you know, our thing, and also the idea that he said it'll cost us millions at the box office. We were like, millions? Are you crazy? This movie's not going to make millions. Like, what kind of expectation do these people have of this movie? Obviously now you can look back on it, and it's a funny story, and the movie made a ton of money, and everybody, most people really love that ending, you know. And I think it's really like, for us, like, how else do you end Blair Witch? You know, like, how else do you end this movie you don't see anything really. You see a couple little things. Most of the dialogue is delivered, you know, with characters that aren't even on screen. It's more of like an audio drama, you know, than a movie. And it's, you know, it's a home movie, like what, you know, so, you know, it just worked. And again, it's like, you know, I've said it a million times, like there was like this crazy amount of serendipity when we were making Blair Witch, like everything kind of just fell into place and the money came in, you know, at the right time. And we were faced with a problem and there was a connection somewhere and we solved it and everything, you know, just everything kind of worked out. And then the marketing, you know, the internet happened to be the right size to kind of exploit it for this kind of movie. You know, everything just kind of fell into place. And, you know, and the fact that, you know, the distributor let us go with our ending, you know, it's pretty rare. And we were just like, again, we look back on it, we're like, man, that was crazy that all this stuff happened and they let us do that. But again, it was like this incredible amount of good luck and good fortune. And I feel now to this day, like so blessed to have been a part of this movie because it was so collaborative and it wouldn't have happened without, you know, everybody involved. You know, again, I'm talking to you because of this movie and I just feel like, you know, again, just really lucky to have been a part of it. And, but you know, it was just this great thing that we knew was never going to happen to us again. Like we're like, man, we're using all our good luck, on this movie. And, so, you know, again, it was this really, it's an experimental film that somehow worked and, you know, we were all very grateful for it.
I guess no discussion of Blair Witch is complete without a discussion, I suppose, about like the extracurricular storytelling around the film, like the story that people were sold or that was suggested to them that this really was a true story. Like I believe the actors were listed as missing, presumed dead on IMDb and all sorts. There was a community of people online who were really invested in all the clues around the case. And, you know, you had built this website as a hub for like all the theories and speculation. Did people, like when it was all revealed what the Blair Witch Project really was, did people accept it as, you know, a bit of fun or, you know, similar to when Orson Welles pulled a very similar trick with the War of the Worlds broadcast back in the 1930s? Were there kind of people who were furious at you for the trick you played on them?
I mean, I'm sure there were people that were furious. And like when we, you know, we were well aware of, you know, big fans of, you know, Orson Welles and War of the Worlds and just that whole phenomena that happened. It's just so interesting, you know? And we were like, you know, you can't really tell people this is real. That's dishonest and people are going to be mad and that and all that stuff. So we were like, yeah, you know, you can't tell people that it's real, but you know, you don't have to tell people that it's not real. You know what I mean? Like the website, like if you, even our original website, if you dug down deep enough, there was bios about us, the writer, director and the editor, you know, like it was a normal movie, you know, production designer, you know, Ben Rock, you know, like it had all the, had our pictures and, you know, but so I think that like, and then when we sold to Artisan, they told us, no, we know we love your website and we love, you know, we're going to market it as real, as like it really happened. We're going to keep the actors, you know, off of television and off out of interviews for the first 2 weeks. And again, we, Dan and I kind of became the, you know, the poster kid children for the movie. And we never lied. Like, you know, obviously we're not going to tell people in an interview like, oh no, it's real, man. We found this, you know, it wasn't that, but, and they didn't ask us to lie, but they figured, well, you know, obviously the people that are reading these interviews and stuff are going to know it's not real, but the vast majority of the people that are going to go see it are going to feel at least the first couple of weeks that this is not, that this is real. This is like a, you know, a real, you know, a documentary. And you know, we were like, all right, if you guys seem to know what you're doing, you bought the movie and you know, we'll go along with it. Because we were really afraid of the backlash, like you were saying. I mean, like, we were like, you know, we could market it as real, but then when people find out that it's not real, are people going to be so angry that they're going to like, you know, not that they're going to like come after us, but just kind of spread like bad feelings about the movie. And, you know, we don't want to do that. And also we don't want to piss people off. We don't want to make it, it's like a gimmicky thing, you know, that you can only enjoy if you think it's real, you know? But we found that people were not angry. I mean, at least, you know, I mean, look, at least to us, you know, they weren't angry. I'm sure there was some pissed off people, but most people just really, went along with it, like went, like became part of the kind of the trick, became part of the of the kind of, you know, marketing. Like there's so many people that have told me, oh man, I knew it was not real, but I took my mom and I told her it was real, or I took my you know, my brothers. And so there was like this level of like, you know, oh my God, getting in on it, you know, getting in on the little trick that really propelled the movie to make, you know, the money that it made. I think people were like really enthusiastic about like this kind of trick that was being played, and they wanted, and they, I think they became part of the trick, you know, part of the you know, the playing, the part of the game that was Blair Witch. So, you know, that was very fortunate for us, you know, and look, the movie is very polarizing even to this day. There's a lot of people that are like, oh my God, it's the biggest piece of crap and this and that. And so it doesn't work on everybody. And, you know, it's a very, like, again, it's a super experimental movie. So we didn't expect it to work on everybody, but we feel, you know, that was our biggest fear, is that people are going to be angry and want their money back and this and that. And just, you know, that, and also maybe legal problems. Like, are we going to get into legal problems because of this? So that was, you know, but luckily, you know, Artisan knew what they were doing, and, you know, we had the right amount of marketing, and, you know, the rest is history. But yeah, we were definitely afraid that, you know, that people were going to come and burn our houses down when they found out that that it was fake.
Well, I'm glad they didn't.
Yes, me too.
Ed, this has been so much fun. You've been so generous with your time. Before you leave us, can you tell us about the prospects of maybe the Blair Witch mythology continuing on? Like, I know that there were other stories in this world that you kind of cooked up, that you were toying around with. At one point, there was a prequel set in the 1700s that was initially supposed to be the sequel. But of course, that ended up going in a different direction. I think I also heard recently that there was potentially an idea for a TV show that picks up moments after the original Blair Witch ends. What can you tell me about the prospects of seeing the Blair Witch on screen again?
I mean, you know, I think the prospects are good. I mean, it's you know, it's still pretty popular, you know, IP. It's a very recognizable kind of horror movie, you know, and the stick figures, you know, one of the, you know, most known, I, you know, horror, you know, logos ever. So, you know, Artisan is now Lionsgate bought Artisan, so now they own Blair Witch. And we have gone down, our original idea for, you know, a sequel to Blair Witch was we were going to go back to the 1700s and tell the story of, you know, Ellie Kedward, who was the original Blair Witch. And just, we were, and the, you know, the way I describe it is like the closest movie that it's gotten to is The Witch, the
Robert Eggers
movie. Yeah. Mm. Which I loved. And I was like, so angry. I'm like, damn, this is what, you know, and the idea that I had in my head was a little more raw and like thicker accents. Like I really wanted it to feel like, you know, like almost like a documentary, you know? So, and The Witch looks amazing. And I thought, you know, so it was a great film, but so I was, you know, so that was the original idea. It's like, let's go back and tell the story, and it's creepy, and we'll get, like, you know, actors from with thick accents, because that was the United States at that time. It was, everybody was immigrants, and, you know, it was just this melting pot. And we just thought, you know, it'd be a really interesting story about this woman and, you know, Ellie Kedward and what happened and the kids, you know, and we, you know, so that's what we wanted to do. But Artisan, the company, you know, didn't want to do it. And they went with Book of Shadows, and, you know, the rest is, you know, whatever happened. You know, and then we went back. So our whole thing was like every 2 or 3 years to come out with a new Blair Witch movie about a different part of the mythology. Like we wanted to do the Rustin Parr story, you know, 1940s, this guy, you know, being, you know, talked to by this spirit, by this woman who, you know, feet don't touch the ground, and telling him to go into town and get kids and bring them to this house and do all, you know, just kill them, and just really dark stuff. You know, again, we had this idea of shooting it in black and white. And so that was our idea for the movie, for the franchise. And, you know, for one reason or the other, you know, part of it Artisan's fault, part of it our fault, it never, you know, happened. But we've been back to the Blair Witch Well a bunch of different times. We wrote a script about more than 10 years ago now for a sequel that started like right after, well, it's, you know, present day, but, you know, dealt a lot with Heather, Mike, and Josh. And it's a cool movie. Lionsgate actually hired us to write it. And they actually loved the script. I mean, that's what they told us, but it was just a little too expensive, I think. And we've gone down the road with them on a couple of television shows. We've actually pitched some Blair Witch shows. But I think, you know, like, you know, Hollywood is very kind of enamored by the shiny new object, you know? And I think that, like, us older filmmakers, you know, it's why most of the time they don't ask the original filmmakers to come back, you know, like, you know, like John Carpenter, you know, whether they admit it or not, they don't want John Carpenter directing a Halloween movie. You know, so it's like, and I understand that, you know, you want new blood, you want new ideas or whatever. So, but I would love to go back into, you know, the Blair Witch world. And I just feel like a movie, like the movie in 2016 was, you know, a really good movie, but, you know, it was, I don't know, there were some issues with it as far as like, you know, it didn't really ignite, you know, the way we wanted it to kind of, you know, take over and have a really good successful run. A lot of people complain that it was kind of a remake of our film, of the original. I still consider it like the only true sequel to our movie, but I would love to go back and do something. And I think just television in general, especially now, just lends itself better to a Blair Witch idea. And again, we've pitched several ideas. You know, and at this point, you know, we're kind of like, I mean, we still keep in touch and we still try to kind of keep the pulse, you know, our fingers on the pulse of like what's happening with Lionsgate. But mostly what we hear is rumors about, you know, certain people that are writing it and, you know, other filmmakers, you know, that I know are like, hey, you know, I just pitched this Blair Witch story. And, you know, they've been trying to do something for many years. So I don't know what's going on with it, but I really would love to see more. I'd love to be involved, and I would love to do something in the Blair Witch world. I mean, if they do a TV show, I would love them to let me direct, you know, an episode or two. But I do like the idea that like there is new mythology and new people are being involved, because we always thought that, you know, the Blair Witch mythology at least is open to like any, it could be anything. You know what I'm saying? Like there's no, Dan and I never made things said, okay, it's this demon and this is what happened. This is the backstory of the demon. No, it's just something dark in this area of the woods. And, you know, and the Native Americans were dealing with it before the, you know, the Europeans got here. So it has this long history. It's always been there, whether it's a portal or whatever it is, there's, you know, weird time travel or it's aliens, who the hell knows. But I do like the idea that, you know, this new filmmakers can come and kind of, you know, fill in what we started. Again, I mean, I'd love to be a part of it, but I do like the idea of, you know, new blood kind of coming in and, you know, and coming up with new ideas and stuff, because that's what we meant that, to, you know, we wanted it to be almost like folklore that changes and you find different facts and, okay, no, that's not right. This is right. And then, you know, just because, you know, it's history. So we really love we love the idea of somebody else coming in. But again, be cool to go back into that world, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that the 25th anniversary is nigh and that there is going to be this kind of groundswell again of interest and celebration of this incredible film. Ed, this has been so much fun. Thank you for this great film. Thank you, obviously, for my sporting prowess, which I owe entirely to you.
And, I've never heard Blair Witch, you know, being tied to some kind of athletic achievements. That's awesome.
Maybe it's more, you know, maybe it's more prevalent than we know. Maybe Usain Bolt, maybe that's how he got going.
Maybe, yeah, we should talk. Yeah, send that out there saying, hey, did you become an athlete because of Blair Witch or some other horror movie? You know, you never know. So
it's very possible. But, Ed, thank you so much for this. Thank you for coming on Script Apart. It's been an absolute joy.
Thanks for having me, man.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow,
you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.